On Friday, March the 15th, an act of unfathomable hatred was unleashed on people peacefully praying in a mosque in the city of Christchurch in New Zealand. Armed with 6 guns, a few petrol bombs and white supremacist ideals, Australian expat Brenton Tarrant allegedly drove calmly to Al Noor Mosque in the city's east and opened fire, with a camera live streaming from his head.
The blood is spitting on me, splashing on me, and I'm thinking, oh my God, it's going to happen to me now. But fortunately, I'm alive.
He would have the big gun, okay, and a lot of bullets, okay, and he came through and he started shooting everyone in the mosque, everywhere.
As the shooter approached the mosque, he was greeted by one of the worshippers who said, "Hello, brother." He was amongst the first people to be killed.
I could hear screaming and crying, and I saw some people were, dropped dead.
After finishing at Al Noor, Tarrant allegedly drove to the other side of the city and opened fire at the Linwood Mosque. By the end, 50 people were dead. As the community grieved, the questions began. How could this happen?
As debate becomes more fierce, I am observing that the retreat to tribalism is increasingly taking over.
This one event triggered a discussion across a bewildering array of subjects: gun control, the role of social media in radicalising the perpetrator and live streaming the event, the growth of right-wing extremism and its infiltration into mainstream politics.
Well, Mr. President, people do have a right to be bigots,
Ban the burqa.
What we need is a cultural reconquest of our own country.
Another senior politician suggested his party should use community concerns about Muslims in Australia failing to integrate as a political strategy.
In the wake of New Zealand's largest mass shooting and one of the worst in the world, how do we think about our approach to these issues? And does the way we do politics need to change? This is Please Explain. I'm Michael Batchelard, and this week, After Christchurch. Joining us today is senior writer Nick O'Malley, who's on the ground in Christchurch. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Hello.
And from Sydney, senior journalist and columnist Jacqueline Maley.
Hi, Michael.
Nick, let's start with you. Take us to the feeling on the ground. What struck you about the Christchurch community since you arrived?
I think the most immediate thing you see is an overwhelming sense of grief and kindness, I think. I've sadly covered many mass shootings, and I haven't seen one quite like this one. People have turned to one another overwhelmingly. You commonly see, after events like this, people are so shocked they don't know what to do. They bring flowers. They do things like that. That's common around the world. But a lot of the community leaders I've spoken to here, the Muslim community leaders, said to me they've been blown away about how warmly they've been embraced by the general community here. But apart from that, there's what you always see. There's just this unbelievable shock and this unbelievable grief. Every time you speak to anyone, they make the point this is a small town at the end of the world. They never expected to have to deal with this. Yet here they are.
Is there any blame there for the Australian who is behind this? Is there any shade being cast towards Australia?
I haven't come across that once. I've had my ear out for it because I'd understand it and I'd want to report it. And look, maybe it's there, but I have not detected that once. In fact, on Saturday, the day after the shootings, I was standing in front of a community centre which had been, it was a high school, which had given itself up to become a refuge, an information hub for the families of victims. And I was standing outside there, and a crew from Maori TV saw me doing my interviews, and one of them came over to me and said, "This is not Australia. This is not on you." And I hadn't raised the situation. I hadn't raised the circumstances, but he was moved to say that.
Wow.
So it might be there. I haven't found it.
You said you've painted quite a beautiful picture, actually, of the community, as you say, in the wake of this awful event. And you said that students at a vigil in Christchurch were determined to respond to violence with love and that the light of the candles that they were lighting would start a ripple effect to help heal the city. And then there was that extraordinary haka we saw by the students as well, that sort of swelled in volume and emotion. Mm. But we're approaching a week now after the shooting. Is that sense of hope still prevailing there?
Within the community that is directly affected, there is only shock and grief, and it's an open wound at the moment. In the broader community, I think there is real empathy and a real sense of understanding. There's no optimism here. It's too awful. But I would not be at all surprised if this place was left as a kinder, closer place afterwards. I have that sense.
And they've had these remarkable tragedies of the earthquakes as well. It's certainly had a lot of tragedy.
Exactly. The scars of the earthquake are readily apparent. You can see them everywhere. Half the city is still vacant, flat land as they wait for it to settle enough to rebuild on. And a few people have made that comment to me that, they wonder how much can this city take. It lost, someone was pointing out to me yesterday, it lost 50,000 residents permanently after the earthquake, which in a reasonably small city is very significant.
Yeah.
So there is a sense of grief, but also one of the principals said to me yesterday when he watched with a great deal of pride, I've got to say, his students leading that rally yesterday, and he said this is partly born of the earthquake.
Jacqueline, turning more to the politics of this and how we've seen this radical right, this alt-right movement grow and be somewhat accepted at least on the fringes, you've written about the movement of a social phenomenon called the Overton Window that permits that. Can you take us through that?
Yeah, I wrote a piece about this week because we are in Australia having this enormous reckoning this week in the media and in politics about whether or not some of the right-wing rhetoric that the killer was sort of inspired by has had a place in Australian politics and Australian political debate in the last little while. The Overton Window is a really interesting phenomenon. It was named by a political philosopher, an American political scientist, I should say, called Joseph Overton. And it basically describes the realm of acceptable discourse, acceptable public discourse, and the realm or the sort of spectrum of acceptable political ideas that we can talk about in a society and that politicians can realistically hope to implement in a society at any given time. So the people on the left will try to swing it their way. People on the right will try to swing it their way so that, ideas that were previously sort of uncountenanced or unacceptable in the community can be discussed and as real political options.
And so I think your argument is that the Overton Window in Australia has swung or at least opened up to allow right-wing rhetoric and dog whistling, race baiting, that kind of thing into the discourse in Australia. When do you think that began?
A lot of people have written that, the sort of so-called race baiting and xenophobia really kicked off around the Tampa and that election, the so-called Tampa election in 2001 when John Howard and the Liberal Party sort of, really exploited the Tampa crisis, but also September 11 to win back government, essentially, when it looked like the Labor Party was going to win. So there's that sort of, and that really kicked off a sort of season, if you like, of or several seasons of asylum seekers, border protection and so forth being really a bleeding issue in our politics. But then I would say that the ushering in of President Trump has really been a clarion call to white nationalists all around the world. So the stuff that I wrote about this week was ideas that belong, that come straight out of the white nationalist sort of anthem sheet and belong in realms of the internet that were previously so dark and so sort of obscure as to never be visited, have actually made their way into our parliament. So we saw It's Okay to Be White, that was a Senate motion that was voted on and only voted down very narrowly, 28 to 31 last year. That was put, of course, by Pauline Hanson and under the guise of One Nation. Now that idea is
the government voted for that initially, but then said they'd made a mistake and changed their minds.
They voted for it completely, and they voted for it as they say it was a procedural error that they voted for it. The reporting made it was a very murky at best sort of situation, and depending on whether voters sort of take the government's word for it, I would argue that it doesn't really matter in the end because it was still put up as an idea worthy of consideration. Now, that's phrase, it's okay to be white, is a very, very, was a very deliberate sort of trolling exercise that started in America that was sort of put up in order to wedge the left because in and of itself, what could you possibly sort of... How could you possibly take issue with that statement? Of course, it's okay to be white, but it was basically seen as a way to provoke debate and to get progressives very angry. And it is a trope from white nationalist from the white nationalist world. There's absolutely no doubt about it.
And at the same time as we see the Overton window widening to encompass some of these kinds of debates, we see people, you know, in a contrary way, narrowing themselves by delving down into their sub-communities within the internet and dwelling in echo chambers where they're getting the news that reinforces their current views. So we've got new views being acceptable and then them being reinforced by the internet. Do you think that's what's going on? And is that making us more extreme as a society across the board?
I definitely think so, because it's impossible to form a consensus if we're all getting our information from, as you say, these splintered possible so-called fake news sources and from people who reinforce our own views on social media. I'm thinking, you know, for example, Peter Dutton, the immigration minister, last year raised this idea that white South African farmers might be brought into Australia on some sort of humanitarian program because they were persecuted in their own country. Now, that idea has been, or that sort of policy has been roundly sort of found to be fake news, or what we might, you know, complete misinformation. However, it was raised and given the imprimatur of the Commonwealth Immigration Department by our own Home Affairs Minister. So it's a mystery to me where he got that idea from, but it wasn't from the mainstream media. It was, you know, from these other kind of news sources. It's something that President Trump has talked about. It's something that pops up in various spots across the internet, but they're very obscure spots that you wouldn't know unless you were looking at them because they corresponded to your worldview.
Nick, policing agencies on both sides of the Tasman will be thinking very hard about how they respond to all this, both to the opening up of the alt-right and other aspects of society. One of those things in New Zealand is the gun laws, which it turns out were quite lenient compared to Australia's. Why were they so lenient?
For a few reasons. One, New Zealand has a long tradition of hunting, of outdoors recreation, as well as farming, which is why in Australia you used to be able to buy a range of weapons that you no longer can. The second reason was it had a very effective small pro gun rights lobby, which I was speaking to the president of the police association here. He said that they employed the rhetoric and the tactics of the National Rifle Association to oppose absolutely any change. And so what it meant over the years is governments just decided it was too difficult a fight to get into was that these very lax laws stayed in place, and they were more lax than they'd ever been in Australia. Well, they've been in a long time in Australia. So even when you could buy a semi-automatic rifle in Australia, you had to register it. There's no guns registry here. So these cops have been telling me that in a country of 5 million people, there are 1.5 million guns, 50,000 being imported every year, and they have no idea where they are.
Hmm.
So that's been overcome. Winston Peters, of the New Zealand First Party, has said his party will no longer object. The opposition will no longer object. It's going to happen.
So this is the event that's likely to change them, just as the Martin Bryant Port Arthur event changed them in Australia?
Exactly. It'll be a significant and a rapid change, I predict.
And I know Jacinda Ardern has given us no details about what she wants to do, but do you have any idea?
There will be some form of ban on semi-automatic, military-style semi-automatic weapons. And there will be a buyback. As the Police Association president was telling me, it's pointless to have a ban without a buyback because the weapons stay in the community. How you define a military-style semi-automatic weapon is problematic, and it's a way that the National Rifle Association has been able to block attempts to introduce bans there, because they will say, well, you know, it's not military-style because it hasn't got a pistol grip, referring to some sorts of long arms of rifles, and yet it's still a machine that can throw out 30 high-powered rounds in under a minute. So it's a machine for killing people. This will be a long debate, but I think that, well, this could be a long debate. I think that the political mood is here, that it will just happen quickly and it'll be sweeping.
The other thing that's really come under question there in New Zealand and also in Australia is there's a lot of concern that this guy, the alleged shooter, was not on the radar of security agencies when it's believed that perhaps he should have been. Is this a legitimate concern, or is it just too hard to pick up guys like this?
It is a legitimate concern. Whether or not they could have picked up this one individual, it is absolutely a legitimate concern that security agencies around the world are focusing on radical Muslim extremism, or radical Islamic extremism, and they're not looking at radical white extremism, especially given the number of attacks that have been made around the world by radical white extremists. One of the last massacres I attended that I was at was in Charleston, where a white nationalist killed nine black people at prayer for racial reasons. And then shortly afterwards, I was in San Bernardino, where an Islamic couple did something similar. So yes, it is a concern. If you're going to have intelligence agencies looking in one direction but not the other, it is a legitimate concern, and I think that will change as well.
Nick, governments around the world are now also worrying afresh about the role that social media plays. This event was live-streamed, and the role that perhaps the traditional media also plays. How's New Zealand approaching that debate right now?
It's a very live debate. The Attorney General said on Saturday, I think very eloquently, how can we have arrived at a place where a massive social media conglomerate or company like Facebook can live stream this thing and bear no responsibility? And the reasons are manifold. It's because, you know, the technology overtook regulation years ago. And now this company is huge, and we all depend on Facebook and other forms of social media. And yet regulation and legislation has simply not caught up. And I think that will change. I think it's going to take an international effort, so it'll be difficult. But I think it'll be impossible for politicians now, for our leaders now, not to acknowledge that these things are not just technologies. They are publishers, and they bear responsibility to some extent that we have to work out. They bear responsibility for what they broadcast.
Jacqueline, there's a similar kinds of questions also being asked in Australia about social media, but also the traditional media. Where's that discussion currently?
I saw that both Bill Shorten and Scott Morrison were very, very quick to come out and make a call to social media, you know, the social media giants, and to Google as well, to clamp down on this stuff and to really throw it up as a political issue. I think both of them are going to want to be seen to be really strong on this. From what I understand, in Europe and in Germany in particular, there are very harsh penalties for the social media giants if they broadcast this kind of material or give a platform to this kind of material. And questions are being asked now why the same can't be true here or in the United States or wherever else. And the reason really is because, as Nick said, regulation hasn't caught up, and governments in Australia and elsewhere have been asleep on this issue. I think the traditional media, there's a huge debate about it, and a lot of it's quite navel-gazing. I do think we have seen, you know, with one sort of cable network in particular, the rise of some pretty out there extremist views that aren't countered by views from the other side, and they're given a pretty free kick. So that's a debate that the media will have amongst itself. I don't know if there's much a government can do about that, except maybe, individual members of the government or the opposition can withdraw their labour if they don't like appearing on those particular networks or whatever.
If they don't like a free kick in a national platform.
Exactly. It's never going to happen. In terms of that kind of thing, I think all that we can do as ordinary people is just switch off. You know, if you don't like Pauline Hanson appear, you know, you don't like watching Pauline Hanson or don't think she should be given a platform on Channel 7, then switch off Channel 7.
Finally, an open question to both of you. What happens next here? And I'm thinking specifically about politics in Australia. We've seen Scott Morrison talking about immigration now, but really de-emphasising any of the controversial aspects of it and talking about infrastructure in the states and so on. Clearly he wants to cut the immigration rate, but not to have it to be accused of saying anything against any particular racial or ethnic group. Can politics in Australia sustain that level of relative politeness through to the election, or are we going to revert to type?
I think that this has been a real game changer in terms of the rhetoric that will be acceptable in the lead up to the election. I think that this election is going to have to be fought, you know, very cleanly in that sense. It wasn't so long ago, it was just a few weeks ago, we were talking about the possibility of a Tampa 2 election in the wake of the Medivac bill being passed through Parliament. You know, I would have thought the first medical transfers that are coming from Manus and Nauru to Christmas Island, I would have thought previously we'd hear a lot about that. We'd hear a lot from the government about how much money that's going to cost. I think they're going to have to be really, really, really careful with that kind of thing now, because any demonisation of refugees who by and large are coming from Islamic countries and tend to be, you know, and by and large are Muslims, is just going to be seen as really icky. And I think that's probably for the better. Whether or not it lasts for the duration, it remains to be seen. I couldn't possibly say.
Nick?
I agree. I think there is going to be an immediate change in rhetoric and language. I think people see, and I think they reasonably see, a direct line between the sort of language and rhetoric that's been used on conservative mainstream media in Australia and in the United States in particular. The language that then comes out and is imitated by politicians who seek to win the support of those networks, and violence. I think I'm not overstating it. I think that there is, obviously it's not the same thing, but there is a continuum there which people detect, and I think it appalls people. As Jack said, I don't know how long it'll last, but I hope it lasts. I also think in this country, I suspect people will overwhelmingly back Jacinda Ardern and the extraordinary line that she has taken. She has been very effective these past few days in demonstrating her own empathy, her own grief, and the direction that she wants her country to go in. And I think there will be politicians around the world who will seek to emulate that to some extent, and that probably can't be a bad thing either.
And on that note, we might leave it. Thanks very much, guys. Thanks, Jacqueline. Thank you, Nick, for joining us from Christchurch. It's been a really interesting discussion.
Thanks, Batch.
Thank you.
Hi, John Sylvester here. I'm the Senior Crime Reporter for The Age. I've been a crime reporter in Melbourne for 40 years, covering gangland wars, outlaw bikies, police corruption, and the underworld of this city. And I've seen a lot of changes in the news business. But take it from me, I believe this newspaper is now filled with the best young news gatherers in decades. Our investigative unit is without doubt the best in The Age's history. This mob produces massive revelations nearly every week, and they're doing stories no one else will touch. And in the era of so-called fake news, we need mainstream media more than ever before. Subscribe to The Age. Support news you can trust.
On Wednesday, the burial of 50 people killed in the Christchurch attack began. It's a time for families and the community to mourn, but also a time for people to think hard about what it all means. I'm joined by Rashna Farooq, a young Muslim woman and former Sky News employee. Hi, Rashna.
Hello.
And I'm also joined by Diana Syed, a human rights lawyer. Hi, Diana.
Hi.
Thanks to both of you for joining us today. Rashna, tell us about the decision you took after the news of the terror attack broke.
I decided to quit my job at Sky News Australia. I worked here for more than 3 years in a junior level role. It's unfortunate that it took the events on Friday to happen for me to really realise that I did need to step down from this role and did need to be with a company that had the same ethical values that I do.
So what about their ethical values did you object to?
Because I worked on Sky News After Dark. So these are the shows where commentators come on and have very strong opinions. In my view, they were legitimizing those fringe views in Australia.
And just to clarify, you're a young Muslim woman, and
yeah.
Was it particularly the views about Islam that you objected to?
Yes, those were the ones that hurt me personally. Yeah, while the rhetoric around immigrants and Muslims, which I am both an immigrant and a Muslim, was personally hurtful to me. I saw the problem in a lot of the things that were being said.
And you've said that you thought they legitimised this kind of thought more broadly in Australia. Do you think your resignation is likely to make any difference to that?
I can't say for sure. I know that it has created some conversations, which are really important conversations for us to have right now. The media needs to reevaluate the role that it plays in tragedies like this. I do hope that there is change. There is strong editorial policies that are put into place, but we'll see.
Turning to you, Diana, Waleed Ali said this attack was sadly not shocking to him. How do you feel about it? Were you shocked or surprised by the events in Christchurch?
Just before I answer that question, I just want to firstly acknowledge my Muslim brothers and sisters that have been impacted by this sort of terrorist attack in Christchurch. And I really want to make sure that the grieving families get the acknowledgement that the pain that they're experiencing right now is unfathomable, and I can't even imagine what they're experiencing now and will continue to experience for a long time yet. As tragic as this sort of terrorist attack was last Friday, it didn't come as a shock at all. And that's something that I think people outside these minority communities were surprised to hear. For them, I think that people, they were reeling from it and couldn't fathom that something like this could happen so close to our homes in our neighbouring country by an Australian. But for those who have had years of this narrative directed at them, the dangerous sort of political rhetoric, the dehumanisation of us as a people, and the othering that we experience in our everyday lives, it wasn't a shock. And I hope with every ounce of my being as a Muslim woman, but also as a refugee to this country, that this is a watershed moment and a tipping point for us to wake up.
Do you feel in the wake of that feeling, do you feel that this might jolt us in some way, bring us to our senses?
I hope that we can go sort of understand that this is a day of reckoning for everyone. It's not just the Muslim community that is suffering through this. We've seen the outpouring of solidarity and flowers outside of mosques and people sharing their thoughts and prayers on social media. But it's not just that we need now. We need definitive action from our political leaders, from those in the media landscape to actually take responsibility for their role in this, and understanding that they have been waging a very dangerous sort of narrative in the way that they've been framing people, and that it does radicalise certain communities and justify their legitimate bigotry and their ideas and racism. And we need to call it for what it is.
One of the things you talked about there was the role of the media. And Rushna, you're obviously, your resignation is a reflection on that part of the media. But there's also been a lot of blowback here against social media, both the kind of forums where this kind of speech is freely made, and also for live streaming that event and taking a long time to get it down offline. There's obviously Sky News showed parts of that, and there's obviously crossover between social media and mainstream media here. Do you look at one or other of those as being more to blame?
So Facebook has been, you know, complicit in this because they have time and time again said that we're not actually publishing the news. People are the ones that are publishing our news. This is just a platform for people to access the news. And I think what Jacinta Ardern said very recently was, no, they need to step up and they need to take responsibility for what's being put out on their platform, because Facebook and Twitter and Google News, they're not just like collating news. They're actually where people turn to get their news. They're basically operating or playing a role of a news organization. They're telling people, you know, this is on top of your timeline, so this is the most important thing and you need to, you know, engage with this. They need to be responsible as well.
Diana?
These social media platforms, we've seen how irresponsible they've been in amplifying the voices of these extremists' views and creating the space for it to become mainstream. And there is definitely a responsibility that they hold to curtail hate speech. You know, this sort of like vilification of whole minority groups, you know, incitement to violence, interviewing people from the right-wing fringes, is something that they would never entertain if it was around Islamic, you know, Islamist groups. They would never allow those voices to be given these sorts of platforms. They would never allow those voices to reach their airwaves in the same way that they do with right-wing extremist views. So these social media companies, and I would like to also point out that Facebook and Twitter, we've done extensive research on how, for example, Facebook allowed a lot of hate speech to go viral on their platforms during the Rohingya crisis. And although they weren't perpetuating the crimes, they were allowing this hate speech to be disseminated on their platform, and there needs to be a clear line in the sand around responsibility. And we've seen with Twitter, for example, as well, the way that online abuse, like these ideas don't just stop when you log off. It's a reflection of what happens offline as well. And it's coming to a tipping point now where, you know, in our globalized, increasing sort of capitalist nationhood, these borders and national securities, it's also sort of outdated mode of thinking. We have to allow protections for minority groups, and we have to be really staunch in holding the line for them, because it actually gets to a point where people's lives are on the line.
Do you think there's a need here for legal change or greater regulation of the social media platforms?
Absolutely. And we've been calling for it for a really long time now. Facebook, the International Criminal Court, that the situation in Myanmar with the Rohingya genocide and ethnic cleansing was referred to the International Criminal Court. And Facebook has had to be held accountable for the role that they played in disseminating all the hate speech against the Rohingya minorities. Now, that's just one example of where social media companies are not just operating as a mere platform, but they have to be accountable for the hate speech that is being disseminated on their platforms. Dr. Anne Ali, a Muslim member of parliament, and she's disbanded her Twitter because of the vitriol she received. Waleed Ali doesn't even want to go on Twitter because his wife, Susan Carlin, already experiences enough Islamophobia for the both of them combined. So these aren't safe spaces for people, and it does actually have a silencing effect, which limits people's human rights to engage in free speech. But free, safe, and equal speech is what we're trying to get at, not the dissemination of bigotry and hate. You don't have a right to be a bigot in this country.
Roshna, how do you think young Muslims, or Muslims in general, will react now that this attack has taken place in Christchurch?
It's really complicated, and I think a lot of young people that I really respect and a lot of young people that I know have come out and demanded change. And I think that they will continue to demand change, but I hope that they are given the platforms that unfortunately a lot of right-wing, you know, almost fascist bigots have been given. I hope that we as young Muslim people are also given some time to, you know, talk about our community, to be behind the scenes as well, create content. Because I think at all levels there needs to be diversity for there to be greater understanding and there to be greater accountability within the media.
In light of the New Zealand attack, New Zealand is talking about strengthening gun laws, and this is really a question for both of you, for increasing funding to the security of religious buildings and so on. Is that enough?
The gun laws, I really, really respect that. I think that was great leadership. The increasing security around mosques, I mean, the guy was welcomed inside the mosque. Like, they didn't suspect that he was going to come and kill them. I don't think that it's not welcome. But I don't necessarily think that the lack of CCTV cameras and patrols around the mosques are the problem.
Deanna?
I agree with everything that Roshna has just said. There's no responsibility or accountability for where, like, the language and the narrative and the frame and the dehumanization of Muslims and other minority groups, which has gotten us to this point today. You can put, you know, all of these sorts of checks and balances around our border control and national security rhetoric and all of that. But if you're not addressing the systemic issues, politicians need to be held to account and take responsibility for the role that they've played in stoking hate against these minority groups for their own political gain. They've basically been able to entrench their power because of this. And secondly, the media. Like, I'm still seeing white people writing about Christchurch, and it's not a time for them to be commenting on something that they don't have any lived experience of. This is the time where we need Muslim voices, we need people from minorities and others who have lived experience of this to be talking about it and leading the forefront of the movement for change. You can put all the CCTV cameras and the $55 million security package you've pledged is really disingenuous if you're not actually doing the hard work behind the scenes. And on the one hand, they're pledging that. On the other hand, Scott Morrison yesterday announced a 30,000 persons cut to our migration. So it's just really disingenuous, particularly in the lead up to this election year. And once again, Muslims and other minorities are being used as a political pawn.
The migration cut he's promoted as being about infrastructure and urban infrastructure and travel times and so on.
Conflating those two is, again, politicising that. It's so dangerous the way they're weaponising migration and immigration intake with infrastructure. It's not right. It's actually conflating two separate issues. And it appeals to people who are frustrated in their everyday lives, and then you can scapegoat whole minority communities. That is such dangerous rhetoric. And it's completely disingenuous. And I really am disappointed once again that our government would use such a frame.
Some people have seen it as evidence that they have been affected by Christchurch, so that they won't push out some of the rhetoric that they have in the past. You don't see it that way?
These bodies haven't even been laid to rest yet. And they're already shifting that and pivoting away. It's unacceptable. And once again, I think that people need to come out and stand in solidarity and show allyship with their Muslim brothers and sisters at the election and the ballot box come May, because our government will continue with this dangerous rhetoric until people wake up and understand that it isn't about Muslims or other minority groups that are causing slow infrastructure or traffic jams. It's ridiculous.
Diana, Rashna, thank you very much for that. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to our guests this week, Nick O'Malley, who is in Christchurch, Jacqueline Maley, Rashna Farooq, and Diana Syed. If you know someone who would enjoy this week's episode, please make sure you share it with them, or better yet, grab their phones and get them subscribed to get new episodes every week. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Support the work we do. You can find the link to sign up in our show notes, or just search subscribe, Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. If you want to get in touch, you can. Our email is in the show notes. This episode was produced and edited by David Estcourt and Nicole Presell. Technical assistance from David McMillan. Special thanks to Amelia Maguire. And Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Michael. Thanks for listening.